Hello. Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, March 22nd. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with the Siouxland's five-day forecast, and today is going to be breezy and cooler with a high of 42 and a low tonight of 20. Saturday is going to be cloudy with a little bit of snow with a high of 38 and a low of 30. Sunday could be some rain and a thunderstorm with a high of 47 and a low of 40. Monday, the winds are going to be coming stronger with a high of 46 and a low of 20. And Tuesday is going to be mostly sunny and cold with a high of 30 and a low of 15. Our first front page story is Spotlight on Speech. Siouxland's top students prepare for All-State Speech Festival. North High School junior Alan Qasim, that's spelled Q-A-S-I-M, is hoping he does not break into a show tune when enacting a dramatic monologue from George Orwell's 1984. On Saturday, he'll star as musical, comedy-obsessed detective Frank Seoff in his school's production of Curtains. 2 days later, Qasim will portray 1984's O'Brien during a dystopian piece he's chosen in the acting category of the Iowa High School Speech Association All-State Individual Events Festival at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Playing Seoff on Saturday and playing O'Brien on Monday will not be confusing, the confident Qasim explained. They're completely different characters. His classmate, Olivia Wagner, admitted to having a few pre-All-State jitters. Also a junior, Wagner's chosen to recite some works from Robert Frost for the IHSSA Festival's poetry category. Frost's poems are all about imagery, she said. That's why I really like them. Believing good communicators equal great citizens, the IHSSA annually hosts 27 district contests, 9 state contests, and 2 all-state festivals, putting the spotlight on some of the best high school speech students in the state. According to English and Language Arts teacher Corey Cantrell, Wagner and Qasim will be the first North students to participate in the All-State Individual Events Festival in 15 years. Cantrell said, "We've had some turnover in our speech department over the years. A few years ago, we decided to start competing in speech competitions again because it was what our students wanted," which makes sense given the ISSHA said participation in a speech curriculum can lead to higher test scores and a rise in college acceptance. It can also increase a student's creative, collaboration, communication, and critical thinking abilities, according to the ISSHA. For East High School sophomore Noah Elder, being selected to participate at All-State Festival will allow him the opportunity to espouse on a very personal topic. "I love pie, and that will be the topic for my selection in the after-dinner speaking category," he explained with a laugh. "So, what's Elder's favorite kind of pie? Apple, cherry, or pumpkin? Chicken pot pie," he said in a preview to his humorous speech. East instructor Nathan Irwin said the after-dinner speaking category was a perfect fit for Elder due to his writing and performing abilities. Nolan Moreno's acceptance into All-State Festival in the radio broadcasting category was more of a curveball. Irwin said, "Anyone who knows Nolan realizes he's a very animated speaker. In the radio broadcasting category, it is all about maintaining a professional tone while being able to think on your feet. Nolan did a terrific job in stepping out of this comfort zone." Moreno was just surprised at how hard it was to be himself. "When you are acting out a scene or giving a reading, you get to be a different character," the East sophomore said. "In the radio broadcasting category, I had to be myself." Mackenzie Crawford, on the other hand, is extremely comfortable in losing herself inside of a character. Very active in her school's show choir and theater department shows, the East senior wants to try her luck on the Broadway stage after college. During the IHSSA All-State Individual Events, Crawford is taking a calculated risk in the solo musical theater category. She will be performing the ballad "With You" from the stage musical adaptation of the hit movie Ghost. She said most people will choose a happy, uplifting number to perform. I chose With You because it is somber and romantic and very dramatic. Like North's Wagner and Cassim, this will mark the first time that Crawford, Elder, or Marino had participated in the Allstate Individual Event Festival. But unlike their crosstown counterparts, the East High students are all past participants in the IHSSA's large group speech competition. Plus, Irwin said East has had a strong speech program for several years. He said the kids who participate in speech tend to be the ones who participate in a bit of everything. The skills that they learn during speech competitions will stick with them forever. Irwin added, "You will need outstanding communication skills in everything that you do." Apparently, speech contests also help you when it comes to multitasking. At least that is the case with Wagner. She must balance playing cello in North orchestras as well as the Sioux City Symphony's Youth Orchestra with student council, part-time job, homework, as well as her speech obligations. "If you're as busy as me, you learn time management skills very quickly," Wagner said with a smile. "But when you're ready to crash, you crash hard. If there's an Olympic category when it comes to competitive napping, I would win it." Cassim knows exactly what Wagner means. "When you enjoy what you're doing, you want to keep on pushing just a little bit harder," he said. While Wagner wants to pursue a career in engineering after college, Cassim is more interested in the performing arts. "Performing is something that has become a passion," he said. "This is something that I found through North Speech Program." Our next story headline, Tyson settles three lawsuits involving COVID deaths of Storm Lake workers. Tyson Fresh Meats has reached settlements with the families of three workers who contracted COVID-19 at the company's Storm Lake pork plant and later died. In June 2022, the estates of Ken Jones, 60, a 12-year employee who died on June 3, 2020, Juan Samudio, 60, who died on June 10th and had worked for more than 5 years at Tyson, Victor Bajarona Rivera, a 27-year Tyson employee who died on June 15, 2020, filed negligence lawsuits against the Arkansas-based meatpacker and plant managers in Buena Vista County District Court. The family said in the lawsuits that Tyson and its managers knew of the COVID-19 risk soon after the outbreak in early 2020, but continued to expose workers to high risks of contracting the virus by forcing them to work in close quarters without proper personal protection. The suit also said Tyson's sanitizing and disinfecting procedures and COVID-19 testing and screening were inadequate, and the company did not comply with state and national safety precautions. Each lawsuit sought judgments to compensate the families for losses and damages in excess of $10,000. Storm Lake attorney Willis Hamilton, whose firm represented the workers' families, said they had reached monetary settlements with Tyson and did not wish to divulge the amounts. The lawsuits were dismissed March 4th. A Tyson spokeswoman said the company had no information to share regarding the settlements. Tyson, which employs more than 2,300 workers at its Storm Lake pork and turkey processing plants, had said in earlier court filings that it was not liable for the workers' deaths. A similar lawsuit filed in Buena Vista County against Tyson in December of 2020 by the family of 65-year-old Michael Everhard, a 27-year Storm Lake plant worker who died from COVID-19 in June 2020, has yet to be resolved. The case has been stayed for months while appeals are heard in similar lawsuits involving COVID-19 deaths of workers at Tyson's Waterloo, Iowa plant. Tyson, in mid-2021, said that, up to that point, it had spent more than $700 million on COVID-19 protective measures and on-site testing and vaccinations for its workers and had hired dozens of additional nurses. Iowa House votes to overhaul state's AEAs. A proposal that would change the structure and funding of Iowa's 9 area education agencies set general state funding for K-12 public schools and boost public teacher salaries narrowly passed the Iowa House on Thursday at the Iowa Capitol. It was the latest legislative attempt by Republican state lawmakers to follow through on Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to overhaul AEA operations and funding, a pitch she made in January during her Condition of the State address in the Iowa legislature. Area education agencies, or AEAs, oversee education of Iowa students with disabilities and offer media and consulting services to schools and students within their boundaries. On Thursday, the House voted to approve the legislation, which is significantly pared back from what Reynolds proposed, and similarly does not go as far in overhauling AEAs as a bill that Senate Republicans passed earlier this week. Only Republicans voted for the latest House bill Thursday, while 9 Republicans joined all Democrats in voting against the bill. The proposal now goes back to the Senate. Reynolds and legislative leaders in the House and Senate have been negotiating their differences. House Speaker Pat Grassley, a Republican from New Hartford, called the bill passed by the chamber Thursday night his caucus's final position. "We wanted to make sure that we went home this weekend that our schools and Iowans had an idea of where House Republicans stand and where our final position is going to be on these 3 topics," Grassley told reporters after the debate. Asked if that meant the proposal is House Republicans' take-it-or-leave-it proposal, Grassley said, "That's our expectation." In a statement issued after the bill passed Thursday, Reynolds thanked House Republicans for passing a bill that represents a compromise that honors the intent of her original proposal. Reynolds said in a statement, "Today's vote by the House paves a path forward to further strengthen Iowa's education system in meaningful ways. Every student deserves a quality education that helps them reach their potential. By reforming the AEA system, empowering school districts, and improving oversight and transparency, we are committing to better outcomes and brighter futures for Iowa students with disabilities. They deserve nothing less." Senator Jack Whitfer, a Republican from Grimes and the Senate Majority Leader, said in a statement he is happy to see progress on the topics covered in the latest House bill. He said Senate Republicans will discuss the new proposal next week and that he is looking forward to resolution on these issues. Democrats levied heavy criticism of the bill and the legislative process that brought it to the House debate Thursday night. Republican leaders set a hard deadline for a debate to be concluded by 6:30 p.m., which prevented Democrats from speaking on the bill beyond that point. During their remarks, just shy of 2 hours of debate, Democrats called on Republicans to ditch the proposal altogether and form a task force to study the topic and area education agencies after the legislative session and have that task force make recommendations next year. They also read letters and emails from special education professionals and families who pleaded with legislators to not change the way AEA services are delivered. Democrats also charged that the entire legislative proposal is simply a political ploy by Reynolds and pushed back at some Republicans' assertion that their remarks were fear-mongering. Representative Jennifer Confers, the leader of the House Democrats from Windsor Heights, said, "There are consequences to every part of this legislation, unintended and intended consequences. It's already happening, and nothing about what we're doing today is exaggerated or fear-mongering." 2 House Republicans with students who have received special education services from AEA spoke in favor of the bill. Representative Chad Ingalls, a Republican from Brandalia, who has 2 children with Down syndrome, said, "I want to make it very clear that AEAs are not failing students. The people that work in the AEAs are not failing the students. My 2 children have benefited greatly because of the people that work at the AEA." Representative Skylar Wheeler, a Republican from Hall, said he asked to be the bill's manager because he has a 5-year-old daughter with autism who receives special education services from an AEA. Wheeler said during the debate, "I assigned it because I knew if this deals with special education, this deals with my daughter's future. But it also deals with so many of the different families and individuals that I know in the disabilities community. To say that this is destroying them, an attack on them, disrupting them is ridiculous in my mind. I would never support or push for any piece of legislation that I thought would harm that community." The provision passed by House Republicans on Thursday would keep in place much of what they passed last month, according to a summary provided by a House Republican spokesperson, and combine it with funding for schools and increasing pay for teachers. The plan has drawn strong opposition from educators and parents of students with disabilities who worry that it will hurt special education in the state. Some school superintendents are in favor of the bill, saying they want more control of their special education dollars. Currently, federal and state special education funding goes directly to the area education agencies, which provide support services to schools. AEAs also receive property tax funding for media services and other education services for schools in their region. The House and Senate had both sent separate versions of the bill to the opposite chamber, with major differences in how AEAs are funded and how they provide services. The latest House proposal keeps much of the components of the chamber's previous bill in place. Once fully phased in, it would require schools to spend 90% of their special education funding with the AEAs, while 10% could be used for a special education through a third party. Anawa woman faces federal drug charges. A former delivery driver for an Anawa, Iowa pharmacy has been charged in federal court with stealing prescription opioids from a former customer's home. Sarah Haptonstall, 46, of Anawa, was arrested Tuesday and is charged by a complaint in U.S. District Court in Sioux City with one count of acquiring and attempting to acquire a controlled substance by misrepresentation, fraud, deception, and subterfuge. She also faces charges in Monona County of breaking into former customers' homes and stealing their prescription painkillers. Haptonstall was a delivery driver for Stengel Pharmacy in 2021 and later resigned after it was discovered she was stealing drugs. A complaint filed in federal court said a 2023 Monona County Sheriff's Office investigation of burglaries and drug thefts showed that all victims had been customers of the pharmacy while Haptonstall worked there. A U.S. Department of Health and Human Services special agent said in the complaint that the Haptonstall targeted homes of her former customers to steal leftover painkillers. Monona County deputies on March 8, 2023, took a report of stolen prescription pills and oxycodone from an Anawa home. A neighbor's surveillance camera showed Haptonstall leaving the home. A deputy was granted a court order to place a GPS tracker on Haptonstall's vehicle. Tracker data showed Haptonstall's vehicle had been driven to the victim's home a day later. The deputy met with the victim again, and they discovered a bottle of hydrocodone had been stolen from a bedroom. Deputies interviewed Haptonstall and searched her vehicle, finding a 9mm pistol. She was prohibited from possessing firearms because of a previous conviction for stealing drugs. Several empty prescription bottles were also found. Haptonstall was arrested March 10, 2023, and charged in Monona County District Court with stealing prescription drugs, including Percocet, oxycodone, and hydrocodone, from at least three homes. She has pleaded not guilty to 6 counts of third-degree burglary, 5 counts of drug diversion, and single counts of being a felon in possession of a firearm and possession of a controlled substance. She is scheduled to stand trial in June. Haptonstall previously pleaded guilty in February 2023 to 1 count of drug diversion for swapping out 10 hydrocodone tablets with Tylenol and keeping the hydrocodone for herself while she was a delivery driver for the pharmacy. She received a 10-year suspended prison sentence and was placed on 3 years probation. Haptonstall previously worked as a nurse and has since surrendered her license to the Iowa Nursing Board. Two hurt in crash near Rock Valley. Two people were injured in a single vehicle crash in rural Sioux County Monday, and a person who was following the vehicle was arrested on drug charges. The crash occurred at 3:52 p.m. on Sioux County Road A-54, 14 miles northwest of Rock Valley. According to the Sioux County Sheriff's Office, Sharon Kershian, 71, of Hudson, South Dakota, was driving north when her passenger, who was experiencing a mental health condition, grabbed the car's steering wheel, causing Kershian to lose control of the car and enter the ditch before coming to rest on railroad tracks. Kershian was airlifted to a Sioux Falls hospital for treatment of serious injuries. Her passenger was transported by ambulance to a Sioux Falls hospital for treatment of minor injuries and his mental condition. Sheriff's deputies at the scene arrested a man who was a friend of Kershian's passenger and had been following them in another vehicle. William Hargett, 57, of Sioux Falls, had become agitated and disruptive with deputies and other emergency personnel on the scene. Suspecting him of being under the influence, deputies summoned a drug canine. After the dog indicated the presence of a controlled substance in Hargett's vehicles, deputies searched it and found THC vape. After Hargett was transported to the Sioux County Jail, deputies found THC vapes and prescription drugs for which he did not have a prescription in his suitcase. Hargett submitted a urine sample which tested positive for THC. He was booked into jail on charges of introducing contraband into a controlled facility, possession of a controlled substance, operating while intoxicated, and unlawful possession of a prescription drug. Former Alcester bookkeeper pleads guilty of wire fraud. A former bookkeeper at a South Sioux City counseling office has pleaded guilty of defrauding her employer. Michelle Warner, 57, of Alcester, South Dakota, pleaded guilty Wednesday in U.S. District Court in Sioux Falls to one count of wire fraud. The charge carries a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison. A sentencing date has not yet been set. Warner was a bookkeeper, accountant, and business administrator at Heartland Counseling Services in South Sioux City. An indictment said that from June 1, 2018 until May 17, 2022, she made additional and unauthorized payroll payments to herself totaling $28,772, causing the company to remit additional payroll tax to the IRS on her behalf. She also was charged with using her employer's credit card for personal use. According to a plea agreement filed in the case, Warner will pay $261,066 in restitution to Heartland Counseling. Nine other counts of wire fraud will be dismissed. Ho-Chunk Nonprofit gets a $2 million donation. Winnebago, Nebraska. The billionaire philanthropist Mackenzie Scott has given $2 million to the Ho-Chunk Community Development Corporation. The award, given through Scott's nonprofit organization Yield Giving, was announced Tuesday. It was part of a much larger basket of donations, $640 million to 361 small nonprofits that applied. A total of 6,353 nonprofits applied for the grants. Christine Earth, executive director of the Ho-Chunk Development Corporation, told the Journal by phone on Tuesday that the organization was surprised to find out how much they had been given by Scott, the ex-wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. Earth said, "We initially proposed for $1 million, so to discover that they doubled their award was so exciting. The nonprofit has yet to announce how exactly it will be spending the money. We are taking deliberate steps to consider the most impactful way of using the donation," Earth said. "This process will involve thorough research, stakeholder consultation, and strategic planning to maximize the benefits and the outcomes." The Ho-Chunk Community Development Corporation, Earth said, operates through a hub-and-spoke model. The organization was described in a press release as a centralized resource in the Winnebago tribal community to enhance economic, educational, and social opportunities for tribal members in Thurston County. HCCDC is the hub, and the other community organizations are the spokes, Earth said. And so HCCDC works with all those partners, all organizations, leadership in our community, so the hub and spoke can move in one direction together. This isn't the first time Scott's philanthropic gifts have reached Siouxland. Last fall, the Siouxland Community Health Center announced it had received a $5 million gift from Scott's Yield Giving. In 2020, Northeast Community College received a $15 million gift from her, the largest gift the Nebraska College had ever received. Sterling receives Pro Patria Award, North Sioux City. Sterling, the North Sioux City tech company, has announced that the South Dakota Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve Committee has presented it with the Pro Patria Award, the highest honor that can be bestowed from a ESGR State Committee. ESGR, an office of the Department of Defense, is intended to promote cooperation and understanding between Reserve Component Service members and their civilian employers, and to assist in the resolution of conflicts arising from an employee's military commitment, according to a press release from Sterling. The Pro Patria Award recognizes one South Dakota employer who provides exceptional support to national defense through leadership practices and personnel policies that support employees we see in serving in the National Guard and Reserve, according to the press release. Awarded annually, the recognition is conferred at the state's Military Dining Out Night, a formal event held each winter in Pierre, South Dakota. Sterling was nominated by one of its own, Major Chris Berendu, Director of Strategic Initiatives. The company was presented with a Pro Patria Award during a celebratory evening, featuring keynote addresses from Governor Kristi Noem, as well as the Adjutant General for the South Dakota National Guard, Major General Mark Morrell. Sterling values the leadership, work ethic, and the moral principles that National Guard and Reserve employees bring to the table, Berendu, a major in the Nebraska Army National Guard, said in a statement. During my deployment, the company provided me with outstanding top-down support, and that continued even when I returned home, he added. Brad Moore, CEO of Sterling, said in a statement that the award is an affirmation of our current efforts as well as a call to continue to do all we can in support of our nation's incredible servicemen and servicewomen, several of whom are cherished members of our staff. We are grateful for their considerable talents, leadership, and sacrifice. We are proud to have them on the team. To be eligible for a Pro Patria Award, employers must first be honored with the Above and Beyond Award, must have had at least one supervisor or other representative recognized with a Patriot Award, and must have signed an official statement of support. Immigration stories for Siouxland students. Third graders from Perry Creek Elementary heard from two community members on Tuesday about their experiences immigrating to the United States. Huang Ang from Vietnam and Fang Gan from China spoke about when they immigrated to the United States and their experiences doing so. Gan said, "No matter what culture you have, no matter which country you're from, we're all human beings and we share some essential values. As long as you're nice to people, you are kind, then you will be okay wherever you go." The event was part of a series of events for the third graders to learn about local perspectives on culture journeys. The students asked questions about why the two individuals immigrated to the United States, if their families came with them, the process of immigrating, and how long it took to complete the process. Throughout the unit, students will meet and speak and listen to speakers from Mexico, Vietnam, China, and Guatemala. Gan said she came to the United States for school, and eventually her parents moved to the United States. Ang immigrated when she was 26 years old. When Gan moved to the United States, she said she was surprised because the rural areas were not like what she had seen in movies and television shows. Ang said her biggest challenge has been learning English. When asked why she moved to the United States, she said for freedoms, including the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion. Both were asked what traditions they brought with them from their home countries. Ang and Gan each mentioned the Lunar New Year as a holiday they still celebrate. Kristen Eilders, the K-5 Social Studies and Curriculum Facilitator for the Sioux City Schools, organized the event. She said the fifth graders at Perry Creek have been learning about factors that lead to different patterns of migration and immigration. She said it's important to teach kids about different perspectives at a young age and to recognize the different people who make up the United States. She said it's all those differences that we bring together that make us unique in our country, and that America has a lot to offer, and there are areas a lot of people that are attracted or pulled to America for the opportunities and the rights and privileges we have here. Perry Creek is an authorized International Baccalaureate World School. This means it is committed to a curriculum focused on intercultural understanding and respect, according to a news release. Alder said part of the program is teaching students about the world around them and building their global awareness. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, March 22nd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now move to some entertainment news, and first off, we'll list some of the things to do in Siouxland this weekend. Number one is Hoop Dreams. 16 teams will be competing, but there can be only one champion at the 43rd annual NAIA Women's Basketball National Championships, which will be held Thursday through Tuesday at the Tyson Event Center at 401 Gordon Drive. The next one is about the Broadway play coming this week. When South Park debuted 27 years ago, we did not imagine that creators Matt Stone and Trey Parker would become Broadway-ready tunesmiths. The Book of Mormon, a 9-time Tony Award winner featuring play and lyrics by Stone and Parker, will be performed at 7:30 p.m. Wednesday and on Thursday, March 28th, at the Orpheum Theater at 528 Pierce Street. A third thing is the Pianopalooza. Oprah Winfrey may have been hyperbolic when she called Pianopalooza the greatest dueling piano show in the history of planet Earth. But Des Moines-based Tony Bohnenkamp and Jerry Lorenzen are not letting the old seal approval go to waste. See the guys in action when Pianopalooza hits the marquee stage at 1225 4th Street for an 8 p.m. show Friday night. That would be tonight. Strings and Springs. Harpist Mary Watts will perform a Spring is in the Air concert featuring the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein, Aaron Copland, and more, beginning at 2 p.m. on Sunday at the Betty Strong Encounter Center at 900 Larson Park Road. Ship Shape, 2024's Siouxland's Choice for Best Rock Band recipient, and later this summer, Iowa Rock and Roll Music Association Hall of Famers, Ghost Ship, are coming to Doc's Warehouse at 1219 5th Street for a 9 p.m. Saturday show. And then the last one listed here is Primer Time. Celebrating his 79th birthday a few weeks ago, Chicago blues legend John Primer is showing no signs of slowing down. He and his Real Deal Band will perform a 9 p.m. Friday show at Vanguard Arts at 416 Pierce Street. We'll now move to a story concerning the Academy Awards. From Sioux City to the Red Carpet. When 20 Days in Maripol won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature on March 10th, Jordan Dykstra wasn't on the stage of the Dolby Theater basking in the spotlight. Instead, the Sioux City native was cheering his team on from the audience. Dykstra, a 2003 Bishop Heland Catholic High School graduate, wrote the musical score for the 20 Days in Maripol, a film which revolved around a team of Ukrainian journalists trapped in the besieged city of Maripol when Russian troops invaded Ukraine. The 38-year-old Dykstra had already written scores for such films as Blow the Man Down, Hail Satan, and 2019's Documenting Hate, which had won an Emmy Award for Outstanding Investigative Documentary. However, 20 Days in Maripol, directed by Mstislav Chernov, was a unique experience for everyone involved in the making of the film. Dykstra said, "I think I can speak for the whole team in saying we knew the film was going to have an impact." The film also allowed Dykstra a chance to mingle at the Oscars while wearing a responsible wool suit by Koss, as well as an off-white shirt by Another Aspect, which was at least one nice aspect. 20 Days was such a tough film for me to work on, Dykstra said. I've never wept so much on the job before. And this 20 Days in Maripol is part of PBS's long-running Frontline series, and it won Best Documentary at the Oscars. And now we're going to have an article about Morningside University's free opera productions. And this is Morningside University School of Visual and Performing Arts production of Seymour Barab's Little Red Riding Hood. And it's going to be 7 p.m. tonight and Saturday with a 1 p.m. Sunday matinee. And it's at the Klinger Neal Theater at 3700 Peters Avenue in Sioux City. And the admission is free. The scene, in the New York bedroom of a recently deceased man, circa the 1950s. The greedy relatives of the late millionaire haggle over the contents of his will, breaking into an occasional operatic aria. The situation, Morningside School of Visual Performing Arts is presenting an updated version of Giacomo Puccini's classic comic opera, Gianni Schicchi, as part of the school's springtime musical offerings. Unlike the original 1918 one-act opera, Morningside's interpretation is being performed in English as opposed to its native Italian. Another key difference, the entire class is made up of students who've never performed an opera. The decision to stage this play, this opera, which ran March 14th through the 17th, as well as a second opera, Seymour Barab's Little Red Riding Hood, was made by Morningside's assistant music professor Shannon Sallards Burton. "Each spring, we alternate between doing a musical or an opera," she explained. "This year happens to be our opera year." Both musicals, which were about 50 minutes long, came about through a grant from the Gilchrist Foundation, which allowed them to be performed free of charge to the general public. Morningside Music Education Junior Anna Fulberth jumped at the chance of playing an old woman in Gianni Schicchi, as well as the title character in Little Red Riding Hood. A tongue-in-cheek send-up of the Brother Grimm's fairy tale, Little Red Riding Hood is being performed at 7 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, and with a 1 p.m. Sunday matinee at Klinger Neal Theater at 3700 Peters Avenue. In Gianni Schicchi, I get to dress up like an old person. In Little Red Riding Hood, I get to wear a red riding hood, Fulberth explained. Interested in music and theater from a very early age, Fulberth was making her operatic debut in both shows, though the Spirit Lake native insisted she wasn't too nervous about it. "Opera really isn't intimidating," she said. "It's simply another form of storytelling." Performance-wise, there are distinct differences when it comes to opera, according to theater professor Taylor Clemens. "In a musical, the performed are always mic'd," he explained. "Keeping with tradition, opera singers must go mic'less. This shouldn't be a problem in an intimate space like Klinger Neal, where the stage is in close proximity to the audience. Though it might prove challenging for Wyatt Randeris, who plays the big bad wolf in Little Red Riding Hood. My costuming is yet to be decided," the Denison, Iowa native said a week before opening night, "but I suspect it might be elaborate." Unlike his castmate Fulberth, Randeris is not a music education major. Instead, he is majoring in business. However, the Morningside freshman has a long history in choir and musicals. In fact, Randeris portrayed the Beast in Morningside's production of Beauty and the Beast. "I guess I'm used to wearing masks or elaborate costumes because of Beauty and the Beast," he allowed. "Doesn't that impact how Randeris is able to sing his part?" "Not really," he insisted. "I can sing like I normally would. The only issue is vision. When I'm in a mask, I can't always see where I'm going on stage." Clemens is happy at how game his students are in tackling something new. "A lot of people might consider opera to be intimidating or too technical," he said, shaking his head. "Our productions will be fun, not challenging." This coincides with the thinking of Sallards Burton. "Opera has a reputation for being highbrow, mainly because it isn't often performed in a college setting," she said. "I think our shows will be a nice introduction to opera for our students as well as to the audience." Not Quite Brothers, slate date. Known for their big sound and eclectic set list, Not Quite Brothers will be performing August 30th at Hard Rock Hotel and Casino's Anthem at 111 3rd Street. Fans of Not Quite Brothers enjoy the group's ability to enhance any party. Sam Johnson on vocals and Isaac Johnson guitar are twins. Cooper Cochran on guitar, Ben Schmesler drums, and Nathan Klein bass aren't related to one another, yet they are as tight as brothers. Tickets will go on sale on Friday in person at the Hard Rock Casino SiouxCity.com or in person at the hotel's Rock Shop. Chamber Music presents Show Tunes. The Sioux City Chamber Music will present Her Broadway, My Broadway, Our Broadway, a performance by Diana Woolley and Cassie Woolley Slater at 2 p.m. Sunday at the First Presbyterian Church at 608 Nebraska Street. The show revolves around a daughter who is following in her mother's footsteps. The program showcases the career the two women have had and features glorious music which spans Broadway standards to new musical theater show tunes that will one day become classics. Woolley is executive director and a director of education for Lamb Arts Regional Theater. Her daughter, Cassie Woolley Slater, is an actress and teacher in addition to being an artistic associate for Lamb. They will be accompanied by Donnie Short, who has served as choreographer for Lamb in addition to serving as a teacher for the Sioux City Community School District. Single admission adult tickets are available at the door. Students will be admitted free of charge. Elton John Tribute Show coming to the Orpheum. Tom's Elton John Tribute will be coming to the Orpheum Theater at 528 Pierce Street on August 28th. Tom Cridland, who is playing the part of Elton John on lead vocals and piano, is close friends with Elton John's drummer Nigel Olsen and has recorded songs with Elton John's guitarist Davy Johnston. Tickets will go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday at theorpheumlive.com or by visiting the Prime Bank box office at the Tyson Events Center. We'll now move to some sports news. We'll begin with hockey. Metros win at Nationals. The Sioux City Metros. Grant Harder scored two goals and Cash Frigg added another as the Sioux City Metros beat the Rushmore, South Dakota Thunder 3-1 in the opening match at the USA Hockey National High School Division II tournament. The Metros, looking to advance to this weekend's medal round, will next face Wheeling, West Virginia Central Catholic at 1:15 p.m. Central on Thursday in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Sioux City will finish pool play versus the Greenville, South Carolina, Carolina Road Warriors at 11:15 a.m. Central Time on Friday. The Metro scored first and never relinquished the lead against Rushmore. With 6:23 left in the first period, Frick found the back of the net, assisted by Noah Graham, giving Sioux City a 1-0 lead. Harder's power play goal, assisted by Charlie Eggdorf, increased the lead to 2-0 with 8:43 left in the second period. With just 1.2 seconds left in the second, Harder's second goal, also a power play, gave the Metros a 3-0 lead heading into the locker room. Nate Solma provided the helper on the goal. A Rushmore goal with 7:41 left in the third period cut the lead to 3-1. A Thunder penalty gave the Metros another power play opportunity, which lasted until just 2:12 remained in the game. Sioux City is making its first appearance at Nationals since winning the championship in 2018. The Metros won a team record 28 games in the Midwest High School Hockey League this season. Nebraska hires Washington's Troy Dannon to lead Husker Athletics. Nebraska responded to one surprise, losing athletic director Trev Alberts to Texas A&M by delivering an even bigger one to a new Big Ten member. After all of 6 months at Washington, Husky AD Troy Dannon is leaving Seattle for the job at NU, ESPN reported Wednesday morning. Dannon took the UW job in October when the Huskies' outgoing AD Jennifer Cohen left for USC. Now he's a Husker. Joining the Nebraska family is truly an honor, Dannon said in a statement. He'll be introduced next week at a news conference. My family and I are humbled by the opportunity to be part of such a proud athletics program, institution, community, and state. Growing up in Iowa, I watched a lot of Nebraska football on Saturdays with my family. I've spent a lot of time in the state, and I found that we share a similar approach to life, work, and sports. Work hard, stay humble, compete, and expect to win. There is a storied tradition at Nebraska, more work to be done. I truly believe our best years are ahead of us. NU interim president Chris Karborek, who promised and made good on a quick search process, called Dannon a perfect fit for the Husker role. Kaburek said in a statement, Troy sees the vision and momentum we have here at Nebraska, from our bold investments in facilities to our record success in the classroom to our bold plan to elevate our national reputation and competitiveness, and he is excited to be a part of it. I am thrilled that we have found someone who is 100% aligned with our high expectations and will be all in on Nebraska. Dannon's direct report at the University of Nebraska is likely to be Jeffrey Gold, the University of Nebraska Medical Center Chancellor named on Wednesday as a priority candidate for the job. Uncertainty around the presidential search played a contributing role in Albert's departure to A&M. Previously, Dannon had been the athletic director at Tulane and Northern Iowa. He also graduated from UNI, where he worked as a student in the sports information department. A move to Nebraska would be a move closer to home for him and his family. Washington starts competition in the Big Ten next season. The Huskies will be looking to replace an AD they had just begun to know, one who just hired Jeff Fish to coach UW's football team after the previous coach, Kalen DeBoer, departed for Alabama. Nebraska's move for a new athletic director comes one day after announcing a 5-year guaranteed contract extension for men's basketball coach Fred Hoiberg, who will make more than $26 million over the life of his new deal. And Dannon's arrival fulfills Kaburek's desire that NU move quickly to replace Albert's, who stunned the state, his staff, and Husker coaches by leaving his alma mater after just 2.5 years on the job, just 4 months after a lucrative 8-year contract extension. Dannon's move is in its own shock. He just hired Fish and was in the process of hiring a new men's basketball coach. Such decisions tend to buy an AD some security as key hires get a chance to implement their system and strive for success. But Washington's inability to retain DeBoer, who led UW to the college football playoff national title game, may have provided some pause for the job. According to Dannon, the Huskies tried and failed to sew up DeBoer in the months before Nick Saban retired at Alabama, and DeBoer quickly took the job there. Dannon started at Washington on October 9th. The next day, according to a Seattle Times story, Dannon began working on an extension for DeBoer, who won 11 games in 2022 at UW. We put numbers in front of him that were, quite frankly, unprecedented for this university, Dannon said in January, according to the Times. We put a Big Ten package in front of Kalen. The initial offer, Dannon said in his speech, was $8.7 million per year for DeBoer. After a Sugar Bowl win over Texas in the CFP semifinal, it was $9.4 million, a more lucrative contract than Nebraska has for Rule. DeBoer went to Alabama. Dannon hired Fish. Now Dannon is headed to Nebraska. He's a football guy. Dannon has been chair of the NCAA Football Competition Committee for the last 4 years and currently serves on the executive committee of the NCAA Football Oversight Committee. At Tulane, he hired Willie Fritz, who across 8 years won 54 games for the Green Wave. Fritz's last two teams in 2022 and 2023 finished 12-2 and 11-2. Fritz parlayed that success into the Houston job. Dannon started his AD career at Northern Iowa in 2008. His time overseeing UNI coincided with former Nebraska coach Scott Frost last year as a UNI assistant. In 2009, with Northern Iowa's athletic department facing budget cuts, the school eliminated the baseball program. Before Northern Iowa, Dannon worked 19 years for the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union in Des Moines. During Dannon's tenure in that role, Iowa high school girls basketball switched from 6-on-6 basketball played in half-court settings to a 5-player full-court game, a historic change for the sport in Iowa. We'll now move to Dear Abby and our first letter. I have been married for 28 years. Last year, I was diagnosed with cancer. It was discovered because of a seizure I had at work. They put me in an ambulance, took me to the hospital, and did a CT scan, which revealed my stage 4 cancer. Prior to this, my wife did not work, while I had a well-paying job. This instantly reversed for obvious reasons. My wife was extremely attentive. She started taking me to all my appointments and spent a lot of time with me in the hospital on her days off. This was about a six-month ordeal, and long story short, when I saw my doctors last week, they announced that after 35 radiation treatments and 7 chemo treatments, they can no longer find any visual evidence of the cancer. I was so thrilled I cried. Since then, my wife has been drinking heavily and getting angry with me just about every night. I don't know what's going on with her or what to do. She's the best woman I've ever met, and I don't want to lose her, but she's starting to become violent. Could you give me some advice? Signed, recovering but confused. And the response, your wife may be reacting to the trauma she suffered when you became ill, which meant she had to become the primary caregiver. This, however, does not excuse her excessive drinking and violent episodes. Of one thing I am certain, you must not allow the status quo to continue, regardless of how much you love her. She should be evaluated by her doctor to see if something is medically wrong with her. And the two of you need to get into counseling right away. And because she cannot handle her drinking, she may need to start rehab or join a self-help group. Then our next letter. My 22-year-old stepdaughter has been receiving very large Venmo payments into her bank account. I know this because my husband, her father, is also on the account, and I have access to it. We have asked her several times where the money is coming from. The first time she lied and said it was from dog walking. She has a history of lying. She has recently started claiming that her old boyfriend from 4 years ago, whom she broke up with because she found tons of photos of half-naked women on his phone, was sending her money. Abby, this isn't $20 or even $100. It's thousands of dollars every month. Her ex was a delivery driver. No way can he make that much after-tax money. Where do you think she's getting the money? I say sex, but my husband refuses to believe it. What should I do? Signed, suspicious in Texas. And the response. I, too, suspect that your stepdaughter may be involved in something sex-related. She could be an escort, have found herself a sugar daddy, or be participating in a sex webcam show. She could also be selling illegal drugs. Because your husband refuses to believe his daughter would do anything illicit, for the sake of your marriage, take a step back. Wait to see what transpires. His daughter is an adult and is responsible for making her own decisions. Because she has trouble telling the truth, there is nothing you can do to help. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, March 22nd. I'm Dagna, your reader. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now, researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.